You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's kind of inevitable that each year we mark Earth Day by bemoaning the harm that humans have caused to the environment, followed by pessimistic predictions about the bleak future we face. But Tim Flannery, the Australian scientist whom Geoffrey Mohan called one of the planet's great field zoologists and thinkers in a story in today's LA Times, has a more optimistic view. In his latest book, Here on Earth, he suggests that our evolutionary path may well guide us to choose a cooperative future modeled on a superorganism structure common to ants and termites, in which people and their governments work together for the common good. His book is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. It's great to be here.
All of the information I've been receiving from newspaper stories and documentaries about the environment makes it difficult not to feel pessimistic about our planet's future. Didn't you argue in one of your previous books, The Weathermakers, that combating global warming needs to be the top priority?
Yeah, sure. It does need to be the top priority. And it may not be that in this country here, but what is very true is that we are making progress on this issue. And if you look globally at what's happening in countries around the world, we are, even this year, making very significant progress towards avoiding dangerous climate change. Now, it may not be enough, but the first steps are being taken.
You say not here, but other places. It's my sense that when we get together to work out climate change treaties, that we just had a recent one, that nobody can agree on anything. And the United States is only one of the culprits.
Well, look, Leonard, the fact of the matter is that we agreed on the Copenhagen Accord. And under that accord, every nation adopted a target to reduce its emissions by. And if you add up all of those pledges to reduce emissions, they get us about two-thirds of the way we need to go in order to avoid dangerous climate change. Now, honouring those pledges is going to be difficult. But let's just look at the US, where you've got a Congress that doesn't seem to believe in climate change and have great difficulty coming to terms with the subject.
Well, our Congress can't seem to agree on anything. If you're going to talk about a future in which people all get together for the common good, there's going to have to be a major change in attitude in this country.
Well, that's right. But
we're having hardening of attitudes.
Sure, you are here, and I think that's leading to dysfunction. But just to get back to the climate issue, just briefly, I mean, this country has adopted a target of dropping its emissions by 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. Now, you're already decreased your emissions by 9%. Partly you did that in the least best way possible by having an economic slowdown, you know. But there are other factors at play as well. You've got an emissions trading scheme coming into force this year in California, which will be a big driver for change. You've just had a major victory with the Tennessee Valley Authority closing down 16% of all its coal-fired power plants and having a new build of clean energy. And those sort of things add up in the end. So even without leadership in this area at the kind of congressional level, you are actually achieving things.
You've described your book as a twin biography of our species and our planet. Was it your hope in writing it that more people will come to understand just how interconnected they really are?
Yeah, look, really the book arose out of questions that people asked me as climate change was becoming a major issue. And the questions usually involved, you know, what are our chances of combating this issue and having a decent future? And the only way I could see of answering that question was to go back to the very nature of humanity and the nature of the planet itself and look at what this thing actually is. You know, what are the forces that have shaped it? What are the outcomes of the evolutionary process? And if you look at that carefully, you do see that evolution's legacy is one of enormous cooperation, you know, both even at the level of the individual or the superorganism, as I call it, the society as a whole, or even the planet as a whole.
But the planet is billions of years old. The major problems have really began with the Industrial Revolution, didn't they? We're now seeing acidification of the oceans, which are really the lungs of the planet. And that's something that started in the middle of the 19th century and now has reached, for some people, real crisis proportions.
Sure, it has. And look, we have a narrow window of opportunity to deal with the climate issue. For developed countries like the US and Australia, we have to get the emissions trajectory heading downwards this decade, you know. And that is going to be tough for some countries, but it has to be done. You here have already started. For the developing countries, it's the decade after. They're going to have to turn their emissions down if we hope to avoid dangerous climate change. How we do that without a global government that can say, you do this, you do that, like they do in China, is really one of the issues I look at in the book. And it seems that as we become ever more interconnected, we are gaining the capacity to do that, even though it is not through a command and control system.
Well, we become interconnected partly because we have inexpensive airfares, we have automobiles that are available to many people around the world. But that seems to me to be having the opposite effect.
You are right that some of the technologies we have that are linking people come at a carbon cost, so they make the pollution worse. But they
are, and evolutionists like you fly here.
Yeah,
you cause damage to the environment as you come here to tell us how dangerous we are to the environment.
Sure, and I offset my flights. I know that's not perfect, but I do my best to do that and make sure that we do what we can. I'd love to be able to fly here in aircraft fueled with biofuels. And, if Richard Branson gets his way, we might be able to do that in a few years. But, we've got to work with the world as we know it.
Well, it has been suggested that our intelligence and our ability to develop new and better technologies will allow us to correct our mistakes and set us on a path to sustainability. But are you arguing here that our belief system is more important than our intelligence?
I really think that both belief and intelligence they're critically important, and if I had to choose between the two, I'd probably choose belief as being what's more important. It's what we believe is right, is the right relationship between individuals, what we believe is right, a right relationship with the planet, that ultimately will drive change. And you can see how that's changing, Leonard. If you look around the world, 6 years ago, no one had heard of An Inconvenient Truth. Al Gore hadn't published it. Climate change wasn't on the agenda. You go back 30 years before that, some of the rivers in the US here were catching fire. They were so polluted and people didn't care about it.
Well, they did care about it.
Well, yeah, but they didn't care enough.
Cleveland cared about it anyway.
Well, and did something, but as a group, for a long time, that problem got worse and worse without being addressed, And we are now gaining the capacity to deal with that. And you see it in China today, some of the worst pollution problems on the planet that they're actually now slowly starting to address.
Well, you've taken the long view in this book and traced life on Earth back to its origins. Why go back that far? Haven't most of the problems really been the result, as I said, of post-industrial revolution things that have happened?
Well, if I, to answer that question, what are our chances of survival into the future? You've got to understand what sort of creatures we are. And the only way I could think of to do that was to go back to the evolutionary process and, the foundation stones that Charles Darwin laid down to try to understand the forces that shaped us and what we're really like. Are we so selfish, short-term in our thinking and uncaring that we will drive ourselves into oblivion or not? That's the question.
My guest is Tim Flannery, whose latest book is Here on Earth, A Natural History of the Planet. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. At the heart of your book are what you've called the two great strands of evolutionary theory, the Medea hypothesis, based on the idea of the survival of the fittest and drawn from the ideas first proposed by Charles Darwin, and the Gaian hypothesis, which is based on the holistic analysis of Alfred Russel Wallace and then more fully developed during the 1970s by James Lovelock. Is that fair to say?
That is absolutely right. And what interested me about those two very different takes on evolution, if you want, evolutionary theory, is that they've been there from the very beginning, because the evolutionary theory wasn't just the work of Darwin. It was co-founded by this man called Alfred Russel Wallace, both published together in July 1858, very similar theories in the same journal, but then went on to very different careers. Darwin was a great reductionist scientist that spent his whole life trying to understand the evolutionary mechanism as it pertained to orchids and bees and all sorts of creatures, whereas Wallace was a great holistic thinker, and what he was interested in was what evolution had produced. What was the legacy of this process? And so he wrote a fabulous book in 1904. He lived to be 90 years old, so he was still writing into the 20th century, called Man's Place in the Universe, which was really the forerunner of the Gaia theory that Lovelock
wrote. Well, let's go back a bit. At the center of Darwin's theory, as it's widely understood by people like me anyway, is the notion that humans and other animals are mere survival machines whose sole purpose is to ensure the perpetuation of the genes we carry. Is that a fair interpretation?
I don't think that's a fair interpretation. No, I don't. I think that, you know, when we get a very reductionist view of science that argues about selfish genes and these sort of things, you know, sure, they may explain the evolutionary mechanism, so the mechanism that created us. But look at the world around you, Leonard. I mean, we are, you know, us as individual beings, we are ecosystems of nearly planetary complexity. It's not just ourselves. I mean, you know, I have hundreds of species of bacteria and fungus growing on my skin, and I do wash, but I mean, you know, we have a lot of species that make us possible. We've got about 3 pounds of bacteria in our guts. We can't live without them, you know. So how does that cooperation actually take place in a survival of the fittest world? That's the question. And it clearly, the mechanism may be a ruthless and amoral one, but it doesn't lead to a survival of the fittest world.
Was Darwin just unaware of that symbiotic relationship that we have?
Towards the end of his life, he wrote a book on earthworms that really just started to touch on this ecosystem complexity.
Because he'd read Wallace, or?
No, earthworms for him was a lifelong passion. He kept them as pets in his house for 30 or 40 years. He played music to them. His children would feed them, present perfume to them to try to test what their sense of smell was like and so forth. But what really fascinated him about the earthworms was the fact that they made the soil. And that was the beginnings of his understanding of a complex ecosystem. But really, his great forte was, as a reductionist scientist, just looking at the mechanism. So Wallace was the opposite. He understood the mechanism early, but said, hey, what's it built? What's it actually created?
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll look at some of the implications of what we've been discussing. My guest is Tim Flannery. His latest book, Here on Earth, The Natural History of the Planet, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Stay with us. We're back with Tim Flannery. His book, Here on Earth, The Natural History of the Planet, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. The Chicago Tribune has called this book intellectually exhilarating and called you a sort of real-life Indiana Jones. You have been named Australia's Man of the Year. That was, what, 2007?
That's right, yeah.
Is that because you're credited with discovering 40 new species, or is it because of your environmental work?
Well, the Australian of the Year process is a rather mysterious one. It's hard to know exactly why you get the gong. But I think it was partly my environmental work, partly the early biology I did, but a lot of it to do with climate change, I think, addressing the climate issue in Australia.
Well, you do live in Australia where you can find new species. I guess if you lived in New Guinea, you could have even found more.
That's right. But I was up in New Guinea on and off for 20 years and found lots of things, including some new species of kangaroos that had never been seen.
There are kangaroos in New Guinea as well?
Yeah, they live in the treetops, most of them. They're tree kangaroos. So they're a bit, when you see them, they look a bit like monkeys, you know, up there, but they're members of the kangaroo family.
Isn't the scientific name for the greater monkey-faced bat named after you?
It is, yes. Rather, it's a compliment, but perhaps a backhanded one, Flannery's monkey-faced bat. That's right. It's an enormous black bat that lives in the Solomon Islands, and it's got these really tough teeth and jaw muscles, so it can open young coconuts. It's a really unusual bat. And I am honored, actually, to have it named after me, but it's a strange thing.
Let's get back to Alfred Russel Wallace. You say he was the first modern scientist to understand how essential cooperation is to our survival?
Yeah, that's right. He was writing his book, Man's Place in the Universe, he was fascinated with the atmosphere and how it worked. And he realized that atmospheric dust, for example, is created by living things, and that atmospheric dust has a huge impact on the Earth's climate system, for example. And so he was living at that time when people were just beginning to understand how important things like atmospheric dust were, and he could wax lyrical about them. It's wonderful to read him on it because it seems like a boring subject, but he can really bring it alive.
So why isn't he more famous? We studied Darwin. And Wallace, I realize Darwin published The Evolution of Species because he knew Wallace was going to publish, but he really did beat Wallace to the theory.
Well, Darwin discovered the theory 20 years before Wallace, and they discovered it in very different ways. Darwin typically through his methodical patient science. Wallace, when he was in the East Indies collecting biological specimens and had a malarial attack and in the height of the fever, had this incredible insight about how species were created. So they published together in 1858. Darwin went on in 1859 to write his book, which really was the thing that did change the world. Wallace went on to a different career. He was never really accepted into the establishment, if you want, in Britain. He was a working class man, self-educated. And he took causes on. One of them was spiritualism, which none of us can be terribly proud of, but he believed in, you know, life after death and thought spiritualists had something to say.
He was also, said Arthur Conan Doyle and others.
Yeah, that's right. He was part of that whole milieu, but he was excoriated for it by the scientific establishment of the time. He also was adamantly against immunisation for his own quite valid reasons. He said, you know, it's dangerous to inoculate ourselves with material from other living things. And, of course, the AIDS epidemic shows how right he was with some of that sort of stuff. But he failed to see the benefits of immunisation, you know, that they outweighed those risks in the 19th century.
So he kind of disappeared until his theories were reimagined by James Lovelock in the 1970s.
Yeah, he was always remembered for his zoogeographic work. So the Wallace Line in East Asia that separates Australia from Asia, he's had a name with that. But unfortunately, his great work on fighting air pollution and being a champion of the environment, you know, in the late 19th century, has all been forgotten. And he is one of those forgotten heroes, I think, is the best way to see him.
And then James Lovelock came up with the Gaia hypothesis. He viewed the Earth as a self-regulating system that includes organisms, rocks, ocean, and atmosphere that evolves with the goal of regulating surface conditions so as to always be as favorable as possible to life. But doesn't that make things too easy? I've heard people who have been opposed to even the concept of climate change who said, well, you know, there's a Gaia principle. The world just fixes itself up. It adjusts.
Well, saying that it can self-regulate is quite different from saying that it can adjust to any assault. I mean, our own bodies can self-regulate. We keep the temperature, you know, roughly even, you know, while we're alive. But we are subject to great assaults too. If we are attacked by a virus or a flu, it can overwhelm us. And the same with the Earth system. So it's not an argument for complacency as such. And I think that it's widely recognised today that Lovelock was right. And in fact, the more science that's done, the more astonishing discoveries are made in that field. You know, it was just a couple of years ago, scientists published the concept that the continental rocks of the Earth are actually a creation of life in large part. A fascinating sort of insight into just how deeply life has shaped our planet.
Haven't some critics also called James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis a kind of a neo-pagan, New Age religion?
Those words were used by Cardinal Pell, Australia's leading Catholic in my own city of Sydney, and he's worried about that. But he's at odds with the Pope in that. You know, the Pope's view of climate change is that this is a serious issue and we need to exert our stewardship over the planet and do something about it. So, sure.
One example you give of the Gaia theory describes how coral reefs interact with the atmosphere. Can you explain how that interaction works?
Well, that's again one of the most astonishing discoveries of recent times, that coral organisms produce a particular compound that acts as a nucleus for the formation of water droplets. And so when that's released into the atmosphere, you get cloud formation over the coral reefs. And that cloud formation protects them from overheating and ultraviolet radiation. So it's an interesting phenomenon that has an emergent phenomenon, really, for these complex ecosystems that, again, suggests self-regulation.
Well, the coral reefs right now are endangered. So what happens if they disappear or are diminished to a point where they're not being very effective?
Well, we are learning that right now in Australia. The world's largest coral reef, the Great Barrier Reef, it had its first major bleaching episode, which is where the coral dies, in 1971. It's had 8 since, and with the ongoing warming trend, there are real fears that within the next 30 to 40 years, the bleaching will become so frequent that the coral will never recover. And then what we'll have is the Great Algae Reef. It'll just be a slime-covered rocky area without the biodiversity it has today, and that would be a tragedy, obviously.
Would the algae be able to do anything positive?
Oh, well, they can make oxygen, but that's, in a way, that's why, you know, right, the system will go on. But, you know, what we have now is a system of enormous complexity that it life harnesses an energy budget of 100 terawatts, which is an unbelievably large amount of energy from the sun, and it drives this greatly productive Earth system. Once you do things like destroy the diversity of the Barrier Reef, you destroy the complexity that's supporting that productivity. And so, sure, the Earth will survive, but it will be a greatly diminished system.
But that happens every time there is some major trauma to the Earth. When that asteroid killed off the dinosaurs, the world went on. Other things happened. But if you were a dinosaur, you couldn't have been happy. There were no more dinosaurs.
That's right.
And I'm worried about what that means in contemporary terms.
Well, that's the fundamental question of the book that I wrote was really to try to ask what is the fate of humanity in terms of the planet? One option is that this Medea hypothesis is correct, that life basically brings about life's own destruction, and that we are the instigators of the sixth extinction and we'll destroy ourselves along with a lot of biodiversity. But there's another possibility, I think, and that is that we are evolving towards becoming a planetary intelligence that will offer a level of regulation to the Gaia system, which has been absent up to this point.
My guest is Tim Flannery, who is a scientist, an explorer, a conservationist, currently professor of science at Macquarie University in Sydney. He was named chief commissioner of the Australian government's Independent Climate Commission. And his latest book is called Here on Earth, A Natural History of the Planet. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've described, is it Attine, leafcutter ants, as the greatest superorganisms on Earth. Has that species earned the distinction because its members cooperate so completely?
Yes, they form very large colonies of up to 8 million ants, and they divide up labor within the nest to a very, very fine degree, to the point where there's 40 different kinds of worker ants. And if you think of an entity like that, you know, the nearest parallel in human terms is probably Elizabethan England, you know, population of around 8 million with many, many economic activities happening in that complexity. So their level of cooperation there is enormous. And really an ant colony, the best way to explain it really is that using the words of Plato, you know, when the Republic, when he was talking about the ideal society, he was saying, in an ideal society, there's no difference between mine and thine. And that's what an ant colony is all about. The interests of the individual are totally confluent with those of the colony. Now, humans aren't like that. We're different, but we're still forming a superorganism.
Well, Aldous Huxley warned against something similar to what the ants do in Brave New World, didn't he? And he saw it as a terrible prospect.
Well, it is indeed a terrible prospect for humanity. For ants, it's a different matter. And we will never be like the ants in that regard. We're too willful and we're too selfish. And, you know, we are not driven by pheromones, at least to the extent that the ants are. And there is a difference between mine and thine in human societies, despite everything that Karl Marx tried to do and whatever else. But, you know, the glue that holds us together is different. It's an economic glue. It's the division of labor in part. It's also a common philosophy. And you see now with the new social media that are emerging, the extraordinary capacity we have got to link with each other and give rise to a common human organism, superorganism, if you want.
So you're not concerned about the prospect that things could move in the other direction. We could have a kind of a Lord of the Flies society.
I am concerned about that. And you can see the triggers for that. You know, what could happen in future is that if we destabilize the climate sufficiently to threaten food and water supplies, these nations which still exist and which are armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons could fall into conflict over those resources, and then we would have a Lord of the Flies outcome. And in fact, we would destroy this global superorganism almost at the moment of its birth, which would be unthinkable to me.
Well, what we'd have to do is eliminate a lot of the differences between different political systems. But you're suggesting that the interconnectedness of the world through the development of the internet, advances in communications technology will help humans create a society more like the one, at least in the positive aspects that the leafcutter ants have?
I think so. And you know, I wrote the book before this, these events in North Africa and the Middle East. But they're great testimony, actually, to some of the things I was talking about. Where we've, you know, I was watching the news the other night from coming out of Syria, and there's these people, very distinctly Middle Eastern, with their hijabs on and their, you know, thobes and other Middle Eastern clothes and long beards, chanting in Arabic, and they looked very alien to me until I listened to the chant, and they were saying, you know, the people united will never be defeated in Arabic. And I thought, wow, this is testimony to the empowerment of individuals by these new social media and the spread of and expression of the universal human aspirations for dignity and a better life and, you know, a say in their government.
And you say that democracy would be the ideal form of government for this interconnected planet. But there are many people who don't even welcome democracy. And I'm not talking about the leaders who benefit from being dictators. I'm talking about there are a lot of people who think that we need something a bit more structured and not everyone's voice should be considered equal.
Well, they've got a problem, because the underlying philosophy that I think is emerging from this is one of the basic respect for other human beings. Everyone's vote should be equal. They should have equal opportunity. That's what people are fighting for in the Middle East now, and it's going to be very hard to stop that tide.
But would we have to establish a single overarching global political authority to regulate human activities to really change the way we deal with the environment?
No, I don't think there's going to ever be a single global government of any sort. You can see now what's happening with this, the emergence of these treaties, and we've been very successful recently dealing with them, not just the Copenhagen Accord, which, you know, has moved us along the road to dealing with climate change, but the POPs Treaty, the Stockholm Convention, banning the most dangerous organic pollutants, the Montreal Protocol. You know, we are finding ways of doing this. It's hard, halting, and partial in some instances, but we are making progress.
And then when we talk about trying to save the whales, we have countries like Japan and Norway resisting, and they wind up still killing a lot of whales.
But the whales are recovering nevertheless. I mean, we have a tendency to focus on the downside. And one of the things I find most frustrating about talking about this is that people love to jump from ignorance to despair, because it's the lazy man's way of dealing with it. You know, to admit that
you're saying the grey areas get ignored. It's either or.
Yeah, and instead of saying we are making progress and we can make more progress, but that means real effort on our part, people say, oh, it's too hard, or it's not worth it, or, you know, whatever. We're never going to get any further if we take that attitude.
Your book has been released as an iPad app that contains its full text and interviews with you, interactive maps, slideshows, and social media integration. And your publisher claims that it's the first multimedia ebook to seamlessly incorporate all these different types of media. I guess you see this as the way of the future.
Well, for me, it was a great adventure. I've published plenty of books, but in the old paper medium. But doing this was just fantastic experience for me. It opened a whole new world of possibilities for a readership. And I'm intrigued by it. I have no idea how it's going to go, whether this is going to be a future trend that'll take off or not. But for me, it was very satisfying.
Well, this could be seen both as a Gaian approach to publishing and also a Medean in that it's survival of the fittest, and books are going to disappear somewhere down the line. And people are predicting just that, aren't they?
Some people are, some aren't. Look, in terms of a survival of the fittest world, you know, nothing survives in a survival of the fittest world. Imagine a football competition, which was a survival of the fittest one. You know, you might have a winner at the end of the competition, but you wouldn't have a football competition anymore. That's not the way the world works. So I think the books will be with us for a long time yet. I think perhaps apps are going to be with us as well. But as long as people enrich their reading experience and have access to good quality information that stimulates their minds, I think that's fantastic.
Tim Flannery's latest book is Here on Earth, A Natural History of the Planet, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Lynn. It's been a great pleasure.